could or should be made on an assembly line, even though the term feed the beast has that very idea embedded in it. In fact, the intentions and values of the high-caliber people working in production were surely admirable. But the beast is powerful and can overwhelm even the most dedicated individuals. As Disney expanded its release schedule, its need for output increased to the point that it opened animation studios in Burbank, Florida, France, and Australia just to keep up with its appetites. The pressure to create, and quickly, became the order of the day. To be clear, this happens at many companies, not just in Hollywood, and its unintended effect is always the same. It lessens quality across the board. After The Lion King was released in 1994, eventually grossing $952 million worldwide, the studio began its slow decline. It was hard at first to deduce why. There had been some leadership changes, yet the bulk of the people were still there, and they still had the talent and the desire to do great work. Nevertheless, the drought that was beginning then would last for the next 16 years. From 1994 to 2010, not a single Disney animated film would open at number one at the box office. I believe this was the direct result of its employees thinking that their job was to feed the beast. Seeing even the earliest manifestation of this trend at Disney, I felt an urgency to understand the hidden factors that were behind it. Why? Because I sensed that if we continued to be successful, whatever was happening at Disney Animation would almost certainly happen to us, too. Originality is fragile, and in its first moments, it's often far from pretty. That is why I call early mock-ups of our films ugly babies. They are not beautiful miniature versions of the adults they will grow up to be. They are truly ugly, awkward and unformed, vulnerable and incomplete. They need nurturing in the form of time and patience in order to grow. What this means is that they have a hard time coexisting with the beast. The ugly baby idea is not easy to accept. Having seen and enjoyed Pixar movies, many people assume that they popped into the world already striking, resonant, and meaningful. Fully grown, if you will. In fact, getting them to that point involved months, if not years, of work. If you sat down and watched the early reels of any of our films, the ugliness would be painfully clear. But the natural impulse is to compare the early reels of our films to finished films, by which I mean to hold the new to standards only the mature can meet. Our job is to protect our babies from being judged too quickly. Our job is to protect the new. Before I go on, I want to say something about the word protection. I worry that because it has such a positive connotation, by implication anything being protected seems ipso facto worth protecting. But that's not always the case. Sometimes within Pixar, for example, production tries to protect processes that are comfortable and familiar, but that don't make sense. Legal departments are famous for being overly cautious in the name of protecting their companies from possible external threats. People in bureaucracies often seek to protect the status quo. Protection is used in these contexts to further a small c conservative agenda. Don't disrupt what already is. As a business becomes successful, meanwhile, that conservatism gains strength and inordinate energy is directed toward protecting what has worked so far. When I advocate for protecting the new, then, I am using the word somewhat differently. I am saying that when someone hatches an original idea, it may be ungainly and poorly defined, but it is also the opposite of established and entrenched, and that is precisely what is most exciting about it. If, while in this vulnerable state, it is exposed to naysayers who fail to see its potential or lack the patience to let it evolve, it could be destroyed. Part of our job is to protect the new from people who don't understand that in order for greatness to emerge, there must be phases of not-so-greatness. Think of a caterpillar morphing into a butterfly. It only survives because it is encased in a cocoon. It survives, in other words, because it is protected from that which would damage it. It is protected from the beast. Pixar's first battle with the beast came in 1999, after we'd released two successful films and were putting what we hoped would be our fifth movie, Finding Nemo, into production. I remember Andrew Stanton's initial pitch about Marlin, an overprotective clownfish, and his search for Nemo, his abducted son. It was a brisk day in October, and we had gathered in a crowded conference room to hear Andrew talk through his story beats. His presentation was nothing short of magnificent. The narrative, as he described it, would be intercut with a series of flashbacks that explained what had happened to make Nemo's father such an overprotective worrywart when it came to his son. Nemo's mother and siblings, Andrew said, had been slain by a barracuda. Standing there in the front of the room, Andrew seamlessly wove together two stories. What was happening in Marlin's world during the epic search he undertakes after Nemo is scooped up by a scuba diver, and what was happening in the aquarium in Sydney, where Nemo had ended up with a group of tropical fish called the Tank Gang. The tale Andrew wanted to tell got to the heart of the struggle for independence that often shapes the father-son relationship. And what's more, it was funny. When Andrew finished his pitch, those of us in attendance were silent for a moment. Then John Lasseter spoke for all of us when he said, "You had me at the word fish." At this point, the specter of Toy Story 2, which had taken such a devastating toll on our employees, still loomed large in our memories. Stretched to the breaking point, we'd emerged from that film with a clear understanding that what we had gone through was not healthy for our employees or our business. We had vowed not to repeat those mistakes on Monsters, Inc., and for the most part, we hadn't. But our determination on that front also meant that Monsters, Inc. ended up taking nearly 5 years to make. In the wake of that, we were actively looking for ways to improve and speed up our process. In this, we were driven by a particular observation. It was obvious to us that a large portion of our costs stemmed from the fact that we never seemed to stop tinkering with the scripts of our movies, even long after we started making them. It didn't take a genius to see that if we could only settle on the story early on, our movies would be much easier and thus cheaper to make. This then became our goal. Finalize the script before we start making the film. After Andrew's tour de force pitch, Finding Nemo seemed like the perfect project with which to test our new theory. As we gave Andrew the go-ahead, we were confident that locking in the story early would yield not just a phenomenal movie, but a cost-efficient production. Looking back, I realize we weren't just trying to be more efficient. We were hoping to avoid the messy and at times uncomfortable part of the creative process. We were trying to eliminate errors, and in so doing, to efficiently feed our beast. Of course, it was not to be. All those flashbacks that we'd loved in Andrew's pitch, they proved confusing when we saw them on early reels. In a brain trust meeting, Lee Unkrich was the first to call them cryptic and impressionistic, and he lobbied for a more linear storytelling structure. When Andrew tried it, an unexpected benefit emerged. Before, Marlin had come off as unsympathetic and unlikable because it took too long to find out the reason he was being such a smothering father. Now, with a more chronological approach, Marlin was more appealing and sympathetic. Moreover, Andrew found that his intention to weave together two concurrent storylines, the action in the ocean versus the action in the aquarium, was far more complicated than he had imagined. The tale of the tank gang, originally intended as a major through line, became a subplot. And those were just two of many difficult changes that were made during the production as unforeseen problems presented themselves, and our goal of a predetermined story and a streamlined production fell apart. Despite our hopes that Finding Nemo would be the film that changed the way we did business, we ended up making as many adjustments during production as we had on any other film we had made. The result, of course, was a movie we're incredibly proud of, one that went on to become the second highest-grossing film of 2003 and the highest-grossing animated film ever. The only thing it didn't do was transform our production process. My conclusion at the time was that finalizing the story before production began was still a worthy goal. We just hadn't achieved it yet. As we continued to make films, however, I came to believe that my goal was not just impractical, but naive. By insisting on the importance of getting our ducks in a row early, we had come perilously close to embracing a fallacy. Making the process better, easier, and cheaper is an important aspiration, something we continually work on. But it is not the goal. Making something great is the goal. I see this over and over again in other companies. A subversion takes place in which streamlining the process or increasing production supplants the ultimate goal, with each person or group thinking they're doing the right thing, when, in fact, they have strayed off course. When efficiency or consistency of workflow are not balanced by other equally strong countervailing forces, the result is that new ideas, our ugly babies, aren't afforded the attention and protection they need to shine and mature. They are abandoned or never conceived of in the first place. Emphasis is placed on doing safer projects that mimic proven moneymakers just to keep something, anything, moving through the pipeline. See The Lion King 1.5, a direct-to-video effort that came out in 2004, 6 years after The Lion King 2, Simba's Pride. This kind of thinking yields predictable, unoriginal fare because it prevents the kind of organic ferment that fuels true inspiration. But it does feed the beast. When I talk about the beast and the baby, it can seem very black and white, that the beast is all bad and the baby is all good. The truth is, reality lies somewhere in between. The beast is a glutton, but also a valuable motivator. The baby is so pure and unsullied, so full of potential, but it's also needy and unpredictable and can keep you up at night. The key is for your beast and your babies to coexist peacefully, and that requires that you keep various forces in balance. How do we balance these forces that seem so at odds, especially when it always appears to be such an unfair fight? The needs of the beast seem to trump the needs of the baby every time, given that the baby's true worth is often unknown or in doubt, and can remain so for months on end. How do we hold off the beast, curbing its appetites without putting our companies in jeopardy? Because every company needs its beast. The beast's hunger translates into deadlines and urgency. That's a good thing, as long as the beast is kept in its place. And that's the tough part. Many talk of the beast as if it is a greedy, unthinking creature, insistent and beyond our control. But in fact, any group that produces a product or drives revenue could be considered to be part of the beast, including marketing and distribution. Each group operates according to its own logic, and many have neither the responsibility for the quality of what is produced nor a good understanding of their own impact on that quality. It simply isn't their problem. Keeping the process going and the money flowing is. Each group has its own goals and expectations and acts according to its own appetites. In many businesses, the beast requires so much attention that it acquires inordinate power. The reason: it is expensive, accounting for the vast majority of most companies' costs. Any company's profit margin depends in large part on how effectively it uses its people. The auto workers on the assembly line who are being paid whether the line is in motion or not. The stock boys in Amazon's warehouses who come to work regardless of how many shoppers are online that day. The lighting and shading experts, to pick one of dozens of examples in the world of animation, who must wait for many others to complete their duties on a particular shot before they can begin to do their work. If inefficiencies result in anyone waiting for too long, if the majority of your people aren't engaged in the work that drives your revenue most of the time, you risk being devoured from the inside out. The solution, of course, is to feed the beast, to occupy its time and attention, putting its talents to use. Even when you do that, though, the beast cannot be sated. It is one of life's cruel ironies that when it comes to feeding the beast, success only creates more pressure to hurry up and succeed again, which is why at too many companies the schedule, that is, the need for product, drives the output, not the strength of the ideas at the front end. I want to be careful not to imply that it is the individual people who comprise the beast who are the problem. They are doing the best they can to accomplish what they've been charged with doing. Despite good intentions, the result is troubling. Feeding the beast becomes the central focus. The beast thrives not only within animation or movie companies, of course. No creative business is immune, from technology to publishing to manufacturing. But all beasts have one thing in common. Frequently, the people in charge of the beast are the most organized people in the company, people wired to make things happen on track and on budget as their bosses expect them to do. When those people and their interests become too powerful, when there is not sufficient pushback to protect new ideas, things go wrong. The beast takes over. The key to preventing this is balance. I see the give and take between different constituencies in a business as central to its success. So when I talk about taming the beast, what I really mean is that keeping its needs balanced with the needs of other, more creative facets of your company will make you stronger. Let me give you an example of what I mean, drawn from the business I know best. In animation, we have many constituencies: story, art, budget, technology, finance, production, marketing, and consumer products. The people within each constituency have priorities that are important and often opposing. The writer and director want to tell the most affecting story possible. The production designer wants the film to look beautiful. The technical directors want flawless effects. Finance wants to keep the budgets within limits. Marketing wants a hook that is easily sold to potential viewers. The consumer products people want appealing characters to turn into plush toys and to plaster on lunchboxes and T-shirts. The production managers try to keep everyone happy and to keep the whole enterprise from spiraling out of control. And so on. Each group is focused on its own needs, which means that no one has a clear view of how their decisions impact other groups. Each group is under pressure to perform well, which means achieving stated goals. Particularly in the early months of a project, these goals, which are sub-goals really in the making of a film, are often easier to articulate and explain than the film itself. But if the director is able to get everything he or she wants, we will likely end up with a film that's too long. If the marketing people get their way, we will only make a film that mimics those that have already been proven to succeed. In other words, familiar to viewers, but in all likelihood a creative failure. Each group, then, is trying to do the right thing, but they're pulling in different directions. If any one of those groups wins, we lose. In an unhealthy culture, each group believes that if their objectives trump the goals of the other groups, the company will be better off. In a healthy culture, all constituencies recognize the importance of balancing competing desires. They want to be heard, but they don't have to win. Their interaction with one another, the push and pull that occurs naturally when talented people are given clear goals, yields the balance we seek. But that only happens if they understand that achieving balance is a central goal of the company. While the idea of balance always sounds good, it doesn't capture the dynamic nature of what it means to actually achieve balance. Our mental image of balance is somewhat distorted because we tend to equate it with stillness, the calm repose of a yogi balancing on one leg, a state without apparent motion. To my mind, the more accurate examples of balance come from sports, such as when a basketball player spins around a defender, a running back bursts through the line of scrimmage, or a surfer catches a wave. All of these are extremely dynamic responses to rapidly changing environments. In the context of animation, directors have told me that they see their engagement when making a film as extremely active. It seems like it's good psychologically to expect these movies to be troublesome, Byron Howard, one of our directors at Disney, told me. It's like someone saying, here, take care of this tiger, but watch your butt, they're tricky. I feel like my butt is safer when I expect the tiger to be tricky. As director Brad Bird sees it, every creative organization, be it an animation studio or a record label, is an ecosystem. You need all the seasons, he says. You need storms. It's like an ecology. To view a lack of conflict as optimum is like saying a sunny day is optimum. A sunny day is when the sun wins out over the rain. There's no conflict. You have a clear winner. But if every day is sunny and it doesn't rain, things don't grow. And if it's sunny all the time, if in fact we don't ever even have night, all kinds of things don't happen and the planet dries up. The key is to view conflict as essential, because that's how we know the best ideas will be tested and survive. You know, it can't only be sunlight. It is management's job to figure out how to help others see conflict as healthy, as a route to balance which benefits us all in the long run. I'm here to say that it can be done, but it is an unending job. A good manager must always be on the lookout for areas in which balance has been lost. For example, as we expand our animation staff at Pixar, which has the positive impact of allowing us to do more quality work, there is also a negative impact that we must deal with. Meetings have become larger and less intimate, with each participant having a proportionally smaller ownership in the final film, which can mean feeling less valued. In response, we created smaller subgroups in which departments and individuals are encouraged to feel they have a voice. In order to make corrections like this, to reestablish balance, managers must be diligent about paying attention. In Chapter 4, I talked about a key moment in Pixar's development as we embarked on making Toy Story 2, when we realized that we never wanted to foster a culture in which some workers were viewed as first class and others as second class, where some employees were held to a higher standard and others were effectively relegated to the B team. This may have sounded vaguely idealistic to some, but it was just another way of saying that we believe in preserving balance in our culture. If some employees or constituencies or goals are perceived to matter more or to win, there can be no balance. Imagine a balance board, one of those planks of wood that rests at its midsection on a cylinder. The trick is to place one foot on each end of the board, then shift your weight in order to achieve equilibrium as the cylinder rolls beneath you. If there's a better example of balance and of the ability to manage two competing forces, the left and the right, I can't think of one. But while I can try to explain to you how to do it, show you videos, and suggest different methods for getting started, I could never fully explain how to achieve balance. That you learn only by doing, by allowing your conscious and subconscious mind to figure it out while in motion. With certain jobs, there isn't any other way to learn than by doing, by putting yourself in the unstable place and then feeling your way. I often say that managers of creative enterprises must hold lightly to goals and firmly to intentions. What does that mean? It means that we must be open to having our goals change as we learn new information or are surprised by things we thought we knew but didn't. As long as our intentions, our values, remain constant, our goals can shift as needed. At Pixar, we try never to waver in our ethics, our values, and our intention to create original quality products. We are willing to adjust our goals as we learn, striving to get it right, not necessarily to get it right the first time. Because that, to my mind, is the only way to establish something else that is essential to creativity. A culture that protects the new. For many years, I was on a committee that read and selected papers to be published at SIGGRAPH, the annual computer graphics conference I mentioned in Chapter 2. These papers were supposed to present ideas that advanced the field. The committee was composed of many of the field's most prominent players, all of whom I knew. It was a group that took the task of selecting papers very seriously. At each of the meetings, I was struck that there seemed to be two kinds of reviewers. Some who would look for flaws in the papers and then pounce to kill them, and others who started from a place of seeking and promoting good ideas. When the idea protectors saw flaws, they pointed them out gently in the spirit of improving the paper, not eviscerating it. Interestingly, the paper killers were not aware that they were serving some other agenda, which was often, in my estimation, to show their colleagues how high their standards were. Both groups thought they were protecting the proceedings, but only one group understood that by looking for something new and surprising, they were offering the most valuable kind of protection. Negative feedback may be fun, but it is far less brave than endorsing something unproven and providing room for it to grow. You'll notice, I hope, that I'm in no way asserting that protecting the new should mean isolating the new. As much as I admire the efficiency of the caterpillar in its cocoon, I do not believe that creative products should be developed in a vacuum. Arguably, that was one of the mistakes we made on the film about blue-footed newts. I know some people who like to keep their gem completely to themselves while they polish it, but allowing this kind of behavior isn't protection. In fact, it can be the opposite, a failure to protect your employees from themselves. Because if history is any guide, some are diligently trying to polish a brick. At Pixar, protection means populating story meetings with idea protectors. People who understand the difficult ephemeral process of developing the new. It means supporting our people because we know that the best ideas emerge when we've made it safe to work through problems. Remember, people are more important than ideas. Finally, it does not mean protecting the new forever. At some point, the new has to engage with the needs of the company, with its many constituencies, and yes, with the beast. As long as the beast is not allowed to run roughshod over everyone else, as long as we don't let it invert our values, its presence can be an impetus for progress. At some point, the new idea has to move from the cocoon of protection into the hands of other people. This engagement process is typically very messy and can be painful. Once, after one of our special effects software guys resigned, he wrote me an email containing two complaints. First, he said, he didn't like that his job involved cleaning up so many little problems caused by the new software. Second, he wrote, he was disappointed that we weren't taking more technical risks in our movies. The irony was that his job was to help solve problems that arose, precisely because we were taking a major technical risk by implementing new software systems. The mess that he encountered, the reason he quit, was in fact caused by the complexity of trying to do something new. I was struck by how he didn't understand that taking a risk necessitated a willingness to deal with the mess created by the risk. So, when is that magic moment when we shift from protection to engagement? This is sort of like asking the mama bird how she knows it's time to nudge her baby out of the nest. Will the baby have the strength to fly on its own? Will it figure out how to use its wings on the way down, or will it crash to earth? The fact is, we struggle with this question on every film. Hollywood famously uses the term green light to reference the moment in a project's development when a studio officially decides it is viable, and many, many projects remain stuck in development hell, never to emerge to face the world. In Pixar's history, though, we have only developed one feature film that didn't make it through to completion. One of my favorite examples of how protection can give way to engagement comes not from a Pixar film, but from our intern program. In 1998, I decided that the company would benefit from a summer program, like those at many creative companies, that would bring bright young people into Pixar for a couple of months to learn from working with experienced production people. But when I ran the idea past our production managers, they said, no thanks. They had no interest in taking interns on. At first, I thought this was because they were too busy to spend time attending to inexperienced college kids and teaching them the ropes. But when I probed more deeply, it became clear that the resistance wasn't a question of time, but of money. They didn't want the added expense of paying the interns. They only had so much cash in their budget and would rather spend it on experienced people. They had only so much time and resources, and the beast was bearing down upon them. Their reaction was a form of protection, I suppose, motivated by a desire to protect the film and to aim every dollar at making it a success. But this stance didn't benefit the company as a whole. Internship programs are mechanisms for spotting talent and seeing if outsiders fit in. Moreover, new people bring an infusion of energy. To me, it seemed like a win-win. I suppose I could simply have mandated that our production managers have the cost of adding interns to their budgets, but that would have made this new idea the enemy, something to resent. Instead, I decided to make the interns a corporate expense. They would essentially be available at no extra cost to any department who wanted to take them on. The first year, Pixar hired 8 interns who were placed in the animation and technical departments. They were so eager and hard-working, and they learned so fast that every one of them by the end was doing real production work. 7 of them ultimately returned after graduation to work for us in a full-time capacity. Every year since then, the program has grown a little more, and every year more managers have found themselves won over by their young charges. It wasn't just that the interns lightened the workload by taking on projects. Teaching them Pixar's ways made our people examine how they did things, which led to improvements for all. A few years in, it became clear that we didn't need to fund interns out of the corporate coffers anymore. As the program proved its worth, people became willing to absorb the costs into their budgets. In other words, the intern program needed protection to establish itself at first, but then grew out of that need. Last year, we had 10,000 applications for 100 spots. Whether it's the kernel of a movie idea or a fledgling internship program, the new needs protection. Business as usual does not. Managers do not need to work hard to protect established ideas or ways of doing business. The system is tilted to favor the incumbent. The challenger needs support to find its footing. And protection of the new, of the future, not the past, must be a conscious effort. I can't help but think of one of my favorite moments in any Pixar movie, when Anton Ego, the jaded and much-feared food critic in Ratatouille, delivers his review of Gusto's, the restaurant run by our hero Remy, a rat. Voiced by the great Peter O'Toole, Ego says that Remy's talents have challenged my preconceptions about fine cooking and have rocked me to my core. His speech, written by Brad Bird, similarly rocked me, and to this day sticks with me as I think about my work. In many ways, the work of a critic is easy, Ego says. We risk very little, yet enjoy a position over those who offer up their work and their selves to our judgment. We thrive on negative criticism, which is fun to write and to read. But the bitter truth we critics must face is that in the grand scheme of things, the average piece of junk is probably more meaningful than our criticism designating it so. But there are times when a critic truly risks something, and that is in the discovery and defense of the new. The world is often unkind to new talent, new creations. The new needs friends. Chapter 8, Change and Randomness. There's nothing quite like the feeling you get deep in your gut when you're about to stand up in front of your entire company and say something you know has the potential to be upsetting. The day Steve, John, and I called an all-employee meeting to announce our decision to sell Pixar to Disney in 2006 was definitely one of those moments. We knew that the prospect of our little studio being absorbed into a much larger entity would worry many people. While we'd worked hard to put safeguards in place that would ensure our independence, we still expected our employees to be fearful that the merger would negatively impact our culture. I'll say more about the specific steps we took to protect Pixar in a later chapter, but here I want to discuss what happened when, in my eagerness to ease my colleagues' fears, I stood up and assured them that Pixar would not change. It was one of the dumbest things I've ever said. For the next year or so, whenever we wanted to try something new or rethink an established way of working, a steady stream of alarmed and upset people would show up at my office. "You promised the merger wouldn't affect the way we work," they'd say. "You said that Pixar would never change." This happened enough that I called another company-wide meeting to explain myself. "What I meant," I said, "was that we aren't going to change because we were acquired by a larger company. we will still go through the kinds of changes that we would have gone through anyway. Furthermore, we are always changing because change is a good thing. I was glad I'd cleared that up, except that I hadn't. In the end, I had to give the "of course we will continue to change" speech 3 times before it finally sunk in. What was interesting to me was that the changes that sparked so much concern had nothing to do with the merger. These were the normal adjustments that had to be made when a business expands and evolves. It's folly to think you can avoid change, no matter how much you might want to. But also, to my mind, you shouldn't want to. There is no growth or success without change. For example, around the time of the merger, we were evaluating how to strike a balance between original films and sequels. We knew that audiences who loved our films were eager to see more stories set in those worlds, and of course the marketing and consumer products people want films that are easier to sell, which sequels always are. However, if we only made sequels, Pixar would wither and die. I thought of sequels as a sort of creative bankruptcy. We needed a constant churn of new ideas, even though we knew that original films are riskier. We recognized that making sequels, which were likely to do well at the box office, gave us more leeway to take those risks. Therefore, we came to the conclusion that a blend, one original film each year and a sequel every other year, or 3 films every 2 years, seemed a reasonable way to keep us both financially and creatively healthy. At that point, Pixar had undertaken only 1 sequel, Toy Story 2, so our decision, because it occurred in such proximity to the merger, made many people assume that Disney was pressuring us to make more sequels. This isn't what happened. In fact, Disney gave us a great deal of latitude. Though we said this at the time, our words were greeted with skepticism. We experienced similar confusion around the issue of office space. As we staffed up to meet the more intense production demands, we quickly outgrew our main Pixar building. Needing more room, we leased an annex a few blocks away that would house the next production we were developing, Brave, as well as the engineers in the software tools group, who were working on the next generation of our animation software. Soon after, people began showing up in my office again. Why, they wanted to know, were we separating our tools engineers from all of our production artists except those working on Brave? Why were we splitting up our story and art departments who were accustomed to sitting together? In short, it seemed like every issue, big or small, that arose around this time was chalked up to the merger. You said things wouldn't change. You're breaking your word. We don't want to lose the old Pixar. I should say that this outcry came despite the fact that the measures we had put in place to protect Pixar's culture were working, and in my view, were a model for how to maintain cultural integrity after a merger. Still, people felt vulnerable, and that bred suspicion. More and more, I began to think that many of our employees viewed any change as a threat to the Pixar way, and as such, to our ability to be successful going forward. People want to hang on to things that work, stories that work, methods that work, strategies that work. You figure something out, it works, so you keep doing it. This is what an organization that is committed to learning does. And as we become successful, our approaches are reinforced and we become even more resistant to change. Moreover, it is precisely because of the inevitability of change that people fight to hold on to what they know. Unfortunately, we often have little ability to distinguish between what works and is worth hanging on to, and what is holding us back and worth discarding. If you polled the employees of any creative company, my guess is that the vast majority say they believe in change. But my experience post-merger taught me something else. Fear of change, innate, stubborn, and resistant to reason, is a powerful force. In many ways, it reminded me of musical chairs. We cling as long as possible to the perceived safe place that we already know, refusing to loosen our grip until we feel sure another safe place awaits. In a company like Pixar, each individual's processes are deeply interconnected with those of other people, and it is nearly impossible to get everyone to change in the same way, at the same pace, all at once. Frequently, trying to force simultaneous change just doesn't seem worth it. How, as managers, do we differentiate between sticking with the tried and true and reaching for some unknown that might, or might not, be better? Here's what we all know deep down, even though we might wish it weren't true. Change is going to happen whether we like it or not. Some people see random, unforeseen events as something to fear. I am not one of those people. To my mind, randomness is not just inevitable, it is part of the beauty of life. Acknowledging it and appreciating it helps us respond constructively when we are surprised. Fear makes people reach for certainty and stability, neither of which guarantee the safety they imply. I take a different approach. Rather than fear randomness, I believe we can make choices to see it for what it is and to let it work for us. The unpredictable is the ground on which creativity occurs. Our 10th movie, Up, would be one of our most emotionally rich and original films, but it was also a case study in change and randomness. Conceived and directed by Pete Docter, it would be heralded by critics as a heartfelt adventure, impeccably crafted with wit and depth. But boy, did it ever change during its development. In the first version, there was a castle floating in the sky, completely unconnected to the world below. In this castle lived a king and his two sons, who were each vying to inherit the kingdom. The sons were opposites. They couldn't stand each other. One day, they both fell to earth. As they wandered around trying to get back to their castle in the sky, they came across a tall bird who helped them understand each other. This version was intriguing, but ultimately it could not be made to work. Those who saw it had trouble empathizing with spoiled princes or understanding the rules of this strange floating world. Pete recalls that he had to think hard then about what he was trying to express. I was after a feeling, an experience of life, he says. For me, there are days when the world is overwhelming, especially when I'm directing a crew of 300 people. As a result, I often daydream of running away. I have lots of daydreams about getting marooned on a tropical island or walking alone across America. I think we can all relate to the idea of wanting to get away from everything. Once I was able to understand what I was after, we were able to retool the story to better communicate that feeling. Only two things survive from that original version: the tall bird and the title, Up. For the next pass, Pete and his team introduced an old man, Carl Fredrickson, whose lifelong love affair with his childhood sweetheart Ellie was summarized in a brilliant prologue that set the emotional tone for the rest of the film. After Ellie dies, a grief-stricken Carl attaches his house to a huge bouquet of balloons that makes the structure slowly lift into the sky. He soon discovers that he has an 8-year-old stowaway and eager Cub Scout with him named Russell. Eventually, the house lands on an abandoned Soviet-era spy dirigible that's camouflaged to look like a giant cloud. Much of this version of the story unfolded on this airship until someone noted that, while it worked okay story-wise, it bore a slight resemblance to an idea Pixar had optioned that had to do with clouds. Though Pete had not been inspired at all by that idea, the echo felt too strong, so it was back to the drawing board. In the third version, Pete and his team dumped the cloud but kept the 78-year-old Carl, his sidekick Russell, the tall bird, and the idea of the house being lifted into the sky by balloons. Together, Carl and Russell floated in the house to a flat-topped Venezuelan mountain called a tepuy, where they encountered a famous explorer named Charles Muntz, whom Fredrickson had read about and been inspired by when he was a boy. The reason Muntz hadn't died of old age by this point was that the aforementioned bird laid eggs that had a magical fountain of youth effect if you ate them. However, the egg mythology was complicated and got in the way of the core story. It felt like too much of an aside. So Pete revised again. In the fourth iteration, there were no youth-prolonging eggs. Pete had taken them out, which left us with a chronological problem. While the emotional through-line of the film was working, the age difference between Muntz and Carl, who'd admired him since childhood, should have meant that Muntz was pushing 100. But we were late in the game, too late to fix it, and in the end, we simply decided not to address it. We've found over the years that if people are enjoying the world you've created, they will forgive little inconsistencies if they notice them at all. In this case, nobody noticed. Or, if they did, they didn't care. Up had to go through these changes that unfolded over not months but years, to find its heart. Which meant that the people working on Up had to be able to roll with that evolution without panicking, shutting down, or growing discouraged. It helped that Pete understood what they were feeling. It wasn't until I finished directing Monsters, Inc. that I realized failure is a healthy part of the process, he told me. Throughout the making of that film, I took it personally. I believed my mistakes were personal shortcomings, and if I were only a better director, I wouldn't make them. To this day, he says, I tend to flood and freeze up if I'm feeling overwhelmed. When this happens, it's usually because I feel like the world is crashing down and all is lost. One trick I've learned is to force myself to make a list of what's actually wrong. Usually, soon into making the list, I find I can group most of the issues into two or three larger, all-encompassing problems. So it's really not all that bad. Having a finite list of problems is much better than having an illogical feeling that everything is wrong. It also helped that Pete never lost sight of his mission on Up, which was to drill down to the emotional core of his characters and then build a story around that. I've heard people who've been on Pete's crew say that they would volunteer to take out the trash if it meant getting to work with him again. He is beloved. But the path he followed on Up was difficult and unpredictable. There was nothing about where the movie started that indicated where it would end up. It wasn't a matter of unearthing a buried story. In the beginning, there was no story. If I start on a film and right away know the structure, where it's going, the plot, I don't trust it, Pete says. I feel like the only reason we're able to find some of these unique ideas, characters, and story twists is through discovery. And by definition, discovery means you don't know the answer when you start. This could just be my Lutheran Scandinavian upbringing, but I believe life should not be easy. We're meant to push ourselves and try new things, which will definitely make us feel uncomfortable. Living through a few big catastrophes helps. After people survived A Bug's Life and Toy Story 2, they realized the pressure led to some pretty cool ideas. Pete has a few methods he uses to help manage people through the fears brought on by pre-production chaos. Sometimes in meetings I sense people seizing up, not wanting to even talk about changes, he says. so I try to trick them. I'll say, this would be a big change if we were really going to do it, but just as a thought exercise, what if? Or, I'm not actually suggesting this, but go with me for a minute. If people anticipate the production pressures, they'll close the door to new ideas. So you have to pretend you're not actually going to do anything, we're just talking, just playing around. Then, if you hit upon some new idea that clearly works, people are excited about it and are happier to act on the change. Another trick is to encourage people to play. Some of the best ideas come out of joking around, which only comes when you or the boss give yourself permission to do it, Pete says. It can feel like a waste of time to watch YouTube videos or to tell stories of what happened last weekend, but it can actually be very productive in the long run. I've heard some people describe creativity as unexpected connections between unrelated concepts or ideas. If that's at all true, you have to be in a certain mindset to make those connections. So when I sense we're getting nowhere, I just shut things down. We all go off to something else. Later, once the mood has shifted, I'll attack the problem again. This idea that change is our friend because only from struggle does clarity emerge makes many people uncomfortable, and I understand why. Whether you're coming up with a fashion line or an ad campaign or a car design, the creative process is an expensive undertaking, and blind alleys and unforeseen snafus inevitably drive up your costs. The stakes are so high and the crises that pop up can be so unpredictable that we try to exert control. The potential cost of failure appears far more damaging than that of micromanaging. But if we shun such necessary investment, tightening up controls because we fear the risk of being exposed for having made a bad bet, we become the kind of rigid thinkers and managers who impede creativity. What is it exactly that people are really afraid of when they say they don't like change? There is the discomfort of being confused, or the extra work or stress the change may require. For many people, changing course is also a sign of weakness, tantamount to admitting that you don't know what you were doing. This strikes me as particularly bizarre. Personally, I think the person who can't change his or her mind is dangerous. Steve Jobs was known for changing his mind instantly in the light of new facts, and I don't know anyone who thought he was weak. Managers often see change as a threat to their existing business model, and of course it is. In the course of my life, the computer industry has moved from mainframes to mini computers to workstations to desktop computers and now to iPads. Each machine had a sales, marketing, and engineering organization built around it, and thus the shift from one to the next required radical changes to the organization. In Silicon Valley, I have seen the sales forces of many computer manufacturers fight to maintain the status quo, even as their resistance to change caused their market share to be gobbled up by rivals, a short-term view that sank many companies. One good example is Silicon Graphics, whose sales force was so accustomed to selling large, expensive machines that they fiercely resisted the transition to more economical models. Silicon Graphics still exists, but I rarely hear about them anymore. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. For many, these are words to live by. Politicians master whatever system it took to get elected, and afterward there is little incentive to change it. Companies of all sorts hire lobbyists to keep the government from changing anything that would disrupt their way of doing business. In Hollywood, there are throngs of agents, lawyers, and so-called talent, actors and other performers, who recognize that the system is seriously flawed, but they don't attempt to change it because stepping outside the norm could eat into their revenues, at least for the short term. Why would anybody want to change a system in ways that would endanger or even eliminate one's own job? Self-interest guides opposition to change, but lack of self-awareness fuels it even more. Once you master any system, you typically become blind to its flaws. Even if you can see them, they appear far too complex and intertwined to consider changing. But to remain blind is to risk becoming the music industry in which self-interest, trying to protect short-term gains, trumped self-awareness. Few people realize that the old system was about to be overtaken altogether. Industry executives clung to their outdated business model, selling albums, until it was too late and file sharing and iTunes had turned everything upside down. To be clear, I am not endorsing change for change's sake. There are often good reasons to hang on to things that work. The wrong kind of change can endanger our projects, which is why those who oppose it are in earnest when they say that they just want to protect the companies in which they work. When people who run bureaucracies balk at change, they are usually acting in the service of what they think is right. Many of the rules that people find onerous and bureaucratic were put in place to deal with real abuses, problems, or inconsistencies, or as a way of managing complex environments. But while each rule may have been instituted for good reason, after a while a thicket of rules develops that may not make sense in the aggregate. The danger is that your company becomes overwhelmed by well-intended rules that only accomplish one thing, draining the creative impulse. So we've covered change. Where does randomness fit in? Once, when I was on a retreat in Marin, I heard a delightful and possibly apocryphal story about what happened when the British introduced golf to India in the 1820s. Upon building the first golf course there, the Royal Calcutta, the British discovered a problem. Indigenous monkeys were intrigued by the little white balls and would swoop down out of the trees and onto the fairways, picking them up and carrying them off. This was a disruption, to say the least. In response, officials tried erecting fences to keep the monkeys out, but the monkeys climbed right over. They tried capturing and relocating the monkeys, but the monkeys kept coming back. They tried loud noises to scare them away. Nothing worked. In the end, they arrived at a solution. They added a new rule to the game. Play the ball where the monkey drops it. Randomness is part of the folklore of history and literature. It has been studied extensively by mathematicians, scientists, and statisticians. It is deeply embedded in everything we do. We are aware of it in the abstract sense, by which I mean we have developed methods to acknowledge its existence. We talk about lucky breaks, good days and bad days, crazy coincidences, fortune smiling upon us, or being in the wrong place at the wrong time. We know that a drunk driver can come out of nowhere or, as the saying goes, that we could be hit by a bus tomorrow. Yet randomness remains stubbornly difficult to understand. The problem is that our brains aren't wired to think about it. Instead, we are built to look for patterns in sights, sounds, interactions, and events in the world. This mechanism is so ingrained that we see patterns even when they aren't there. There is a subtle reason for this. We can store patterns and conclusions in our heads, but we cannot store randomness itself. Randomness is a concept that defies categorization. By definition, it comes out of nowhere.